We've been speaking with Robert Young Pelton on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, let me go back to something here that we were just talking about before the top of the hour while we're getting the phone calls lined up. And that was this incident September 16th with Blackwater, which may bring this company to an early end, at least for this major contracts or a reformation of the company anyway. And it would it not be fair to say, based on some of the things that I've read in your book and maybe other things I've heard, that the State Department's reaction to the actions of the Blackwater soldiers on the ground there on September 16th in Iraq, that may have come as this became a crystallization of a problem that they had been having throughout the war of trying to contain these guys. And this one, it was just so egregious that they could no longer find an excuse or a cover for it. Would that be unfair?
Well, yes, but you also have to look at why they would create companies like Blackwater. In other words, why would you give them an $800 million contract?
Right.
It's because they want them to act that way. And they bless and approve and control every aspect of what Blackwater does when guarding State Department employees. So it's almost like you created a Frankenstein and it turned on you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit like our situation maybe with illegal immigration. We want the cheap labor to pick the fruit and vegetables and to work the farms and other, but we don't want to, on the surface of it, we don't want to make it a legal thing for them to do, but we want them to do it so we keep the prices down and the economy expanding.
Yeah, well, the companies like Blackwater, before 9/11, it was just sort of a large training range that made a little bit of money, but it wasn't anything as massive as it is now. And it is really part of our foreign policy, what I call it, you know, our transformative or forward-leaning foreign policy, that requires us to have diplomats. And you imagine the concept of being a diplomat, but arriving at a meeting after you've been shooting at people and weaving through traffic about 90 miles an hour to get right to that meeting.
License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. Your questions and comments for Robert Young Pelton next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Robert Young Pelton is Licensed to Kill. Let's go west of the Rockies. Pete is in Oregon on Coast to Coast AM. Go ahead, Pete.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
Good. I guess I get the feeling you're kind of throwing them under the bus.
Who's that?
Well, the security detail, whether it be Blackwater or anyone else. My uncle is in Kabul as a mechanical engineer working on some of the rebuilding projects there, and he's got a security detail, and I talked to him briefly about it. And, you know, they do the two-car security deal. Wherever they go, they take two vehicles in case one gets disabled and you know, just exactly what you're talking about. But I would, I guess, prefer a Blackwater firm, type of firm, defending him as opposed to maybe one less aggressive because, you know, I'd like to see him again. And to hear that he got, you know, sniped over there because his security detail was looking the wrong way or whatever that way, you know, you see what I mean? It's a function that the military cannot do. They don't have the manpower. The last two administrations have gutted the military to the point where, you know, when I was in Iraq in 91, there were 500,000 troops on the ground.
Well, see, you hit the nail on the head again. The military can do this. The military does do PSDs for generals, and they do provide security services for key, you know, installations. But when we invaded Iraq, we didn't think that we would be sitting there for, you know, 4 or 5 years and also rebuilding a country while fighting a war. So it's considered a short-term sort of bandage to have these private security groups running around. Now, there's about 75,000 private security contractors in Iraq, of which half are Iraqis. And then if you take that component and you cut that in half again, because they have what they call TCNs, third country nationals, and then the rest are Brits and Americans. One thing that's quite disturbing is that we're also sort of outsourcing security into third world countries. So you have Ugandans, you have Nepalese, you have Fijians, you have all these people, like Chileans, that are providing security for American operations, and people don't realize that. It's not all Americans providing this function. So we've turned it into sort of the lowest bidder and the cheapest possible way to get things done.
And I think it's unfair for Pete to say that you're throwing these security details under the bus. You certainly aren't. I've been asking more challenging questions, and I've been pushing you on some of these issues, but you aren't trash room at all.
You know, I'll be clear about this. I have many friends who are security contractors. I've also seen some very disturbing things in this industry. It's like any other industry. You know, you have your sort of high-level and your low-level folks. I want to be clear about another thing, is that the State Department is definitely throwing Blackwater under the bus, but there'll be another company to replace them, and who knows, in a year or two, they'll be thrown under the bus too, and that's just the history of the State Department, whether it's the Montagnards in Vietnam or the operatives they hired in Afghanistan. They tend to use people and dispose of them, and that's exactly why they hire private firms.
That's first-time caller line. Richard is in Texas on Coast to Coast AM for Robert Young Pelton. Richard?
Yes, hello. I've been listening to it. It's a very interesting program. Plan to get the book. I only had one basic comment was on the quality of the private operatives. I understand that he has spoken about some who are basic nutcases. I've met a few myself. I've served there twice now with a private corporation. And mostly when we're there, we're not quite as gun-happy as I think the program makes it sound. Basically, we have, say, a client to move from point A to point B, or a group of clients or whatever, and our basic mandate is to keep them alive and try to keep them out of trouble. And to a large extent, we're trying to move as quietly and cleanly from point A to point B as we can. But Iraq is being the volatile place it is, and it's very difficult at times. I think it's quietened down to some degree. But during the time that I've been there, things will crop up, traffic will crop up, and you get into situations where you must go through these traffic jams. I heard the comment about, moving through at 90 miles an hour. That's the nature of the beast.
Right.
It's a messy situation.
I understand that, Richard. I hate your phone because it's clicking left and right. So I just want you to understand that I'm curtailing this phone call, but not because I don't appreciate what you're saying. It's just the clicking's driving me nuts. So let me comment on it.
The security industry can operate at any level it wants. It can go low profile, which is somebody in native dress driving in a beat up car with a gun held below the window with no display of aggression at all. It can go all the way up to high profile, which are these sort of large armored vehicles with gun turrets and people poking out of it like a hedgehog, using sort of guns as indicators and pointers. It is the choice of the client which way they want to roll. So if somebody says it's going to be very dangerous out today, the client can say, well, we're not going to move. If the client says, no, we have to move and we want to go high profile, which is what the State Department does, then they will set the tone and the pace and the look for that private security company.
Well, I was quoting earlier from the Contractor's Creed, which is at the preface of your book, this email that's gotten circulated amongst contractors. And I had read this part here. I will equip myself with the latest high-speed gear. I will trick out my M4 until it weighs more than 24 pounds, not because it works better, because it looks cool in the photographs. I will carry more weapons, ammunition, and implements of death on my person than an infantry fire team. And when engaged, I will lay waste everything around me. In any combat zone, I will always locate the swimming pool, the beer, and women because I can. How much of that is just bravado?
Well, here's the thing. You have three levels here. You've got what the public thinks security contractors are, what the industry likes you to think they are, and what they really are. And, once you're past your third beer and you're talking to veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan telling you the horror stories, you realize that that's a very macabre but very accurate way to describe the mindset of a security contractor, because he is a disposable item. You know, he's trying to stay alive without air support, without all the tools that the military has, and he is despised by the locals, and he's envied by the rank and file and hated by the generals. So they developed this very curious mindset of being sort of outlaws or sort of outside the normal realm of military functioning over there.
Reading that, that sounds, to go back to Richard's description, that sounds gun happy.
Well, I mean, Richard sounds like he's a security contractor who works with those folks. And I will tell you that in most cases, most of these men are very professional. They're very quiet. They do their job. They do not discharge their weapons. And if they feel something's too dangerous, they won't do it. Now, there are groups of people, and I've rode with many of them, who will use that opportunity of being able to fire weapons at civilians, of doing things that you would never think of doing back in your home state, because they can do it. And they get away with it, and they enjoy it.
That went to my question from earlier. Thank you. Wildcard line, Joe is in Ohio on Coast to Coast AM for Robert Young Pelton. Joe?
Yes, sir. I wanted to call and give my own little 2 cents worth here. I am former military myself, working in the private sector security. And, you know, in this day and age of the new age kids and everything else, and most people not wanting a draft and they don't want to volunteer, then you're stuck between a rock and a hard space. You have a limited number of military, and then you have private security. Now, yes, there are them gun-happy yahoos, you know, that want to go out there and blow their load on civilians, but then there are some of us contractors who, for the most part, do try to keep it quiet. Now, you know, the way I look at it is this. You have a choice between, like he says, you know, you take care of your diplomats, you take care of other security purposes. But when it comes down to it, the military doesn't have the manpower nor the want to take care of half of what goes on.
Sure.
I mean, when we first jumped down in Iraq on the first war, you know, our main purpose was to take care of the oil. I mean, we tried our best so they wouldn't blow it up. Now, that was not done by military. That was done by security.
Sure. Let's stipulate this just for future phone calls, and I appreciate your comment, Joe. Because I don't want to keep going back to that drum. Richard hit it. You did, too. I think Robert's done a great job with it throughout the show about saying, you know, that one bad apple. Okay, fine, and not everybody's like this, and that's good, and that there are a lot of professionals, and we'll all stipulate that. I think that part of where we are with this, the rub of this, is exactly what those people who aren't part of the professional side are able to get away with, and the trouble that it causes for people like you and Richard and all the other people that are private security that are playing by the rules.
Right.
Fair enough, Robert.
The problem is that what's a good security contractor and what's a bad one? And right now they play by big boys' rules, which means, well, we know who the good guys are, but it's none of your business who the bad guys are. And what needs to be done is what's happening now, is people are saying, well, who are these guys and what do they do and what happens if they murder someone, as happened in Christmas Eve in Baghdad, and how do we deal with them if they get out of control? Well, we're just starting that process, and yet this function has been in play since December 12th.
Right. Henry, wildcard line, Sun Valley for Robert Young Pelton, Licensed to Kill on Coast to Coast AM. Henry?
Hi. You know, I was former Air Force, and I've been hearing about them gearing up for withdrawals, but simultaneously building these super bases to handle the big cargo, get big cargo jets and whatnot. I'm wondering, for a political tool, since we do have these bases, these big super bases, but people seem to indicate that they want to pull out, do you ever think that they could up gear these bases to be more dynamic to work with mercenary companies, and that maybe mercenary companies would eventually inherit these bases and configure them more towards their dynamic needs?
Well, let me clarify something. Those super bases that are rumored actually exist. I mean, those are the bases we use in Iraq to service and supply the war effort there, plus obviously the road from Kuwait. But what you're really talking about is the phase after war fighting. If you go into a hostile nation and you fight a war, what do you do afterwards? Well, the military is not designed to do that. So if you have to build schools, if you have to conduct sort of peacekeeping or logistics in a violent or a dangerous area, it's not the military's job to do that. So therefore, they go to the private sector and they tap into the training that these people have received in the military, and they create multi-million dollar contracts. For example, when we're talking about Blackwater and you're asking, are they going out of business, they just picked up a $90 million contract in Central Asia because they picked a weak spot in the Air Force's capability to provide short takeoff and landing aircraft. So Eric Prince invested in what they call CASA 212s, which are small, sort of tiny cargo planes that shuttle people around the various small bases there. So he hit a sweet spot, and he's making $90 million. There are hundreds of opportunities in the reconstruction. We still have people in Bosnia doing reconstruction and peacekeeping.
Let's go to Terry, wildcard line, back in my home state of Minnesota. Terry, when I get home, am I going to have to shovel my walk?
Not yet, Ian, but great show, and thank you for having Robert on. I've always been a pro-military fellow. In fact, an old friend and business partner was actually Jerry Hassenfuss's wingman when he went down in Honduras. You kind of referred to him earlier on.
Right.
So I've always, been partial to people that have had the courage to do those types of things, and have a number of friends that are in security, both domestically and OUS. But we've had a family member that was in Fallujah as a Marine and came back, and it's kind of turned my head around where... And I know you touched on it briefly, and if you could touch on it maybe a little bit more, of how far we actually went in Fallujah and how far we actually brought that city down. I mean, from hearing his stories, it was a plateau that went down about 6 feet from where it was previously. So I guess my concern as a citizen and a supporter of the military in the past is, have we screwed the pooch too far in
okay.
Well, the thing, if you read my book, the chapter opens with a friend of mine who was in Special Forces in Fallujah doing overwatch, bounding overwatch for the Marines. And they had a couple of sort of mandates. One is kill anything that shoots back and flatten any house that anybody shoots from. And by doing so, they created almost a sort of medieval sense of destruction. And what Fallujah did more than anything else is show the Americans as very brutal destroyers of cities. At the time that the Marines, who had studied this, they'd studied Chechnya, they'd studied Afghanistan, and they realized that we can't do this with force, we have to do it with our brains, we have to use hearts and minds. And that strategy was in place until they were told, no, because of these contractors being killed, you go in there and you find these people, you do whatever you have to do. And that was a serious setback for American efforts in Iraq and trying to convince the Iraqis that we were not sort of brutal oppressors.
It sounds like Pinkville.
It was a major misstep in the war, yeah. Because, yes, at that time, Fallujah was a snake pit of, kidnapping, Al-Qaeda, Sunni loyalists, you name it. But there was a time at which people were sort of waiting to see what the Americans would do, and that was the first major campaign. And don't forget, we had our butts kicked when we went in the first time.
Yeah.
There were a number of casualties.
Hang on to that thought. I'm sorry. I'm coming right up to the end here. I want to hear the rest of that, though, from Robert Young Pelton, and your comments and questions next on Coast to Coast AM. Talking with Robert Young Pelton, License to Kill is the name of his book, and the lyrics of Secret Agent Man from Johnny Rivers, coming pretty close to describing what some of these guys are going through who are members of these private security details. While we're lining up the calls, let's go back to where we just were a few seconds ago with Robert, because we were talking about these men, and the caller said, and I thought this was interesting, he said he has a lot of pride in the courage that these military men, have in order to go into these places. But in a lot of cases, too, we should point out that a lot of it isn't so much courage as it is greed. Would that be unfair?
I'll phrase it differently, because in my book, I go into a chapter on training, and I sit and talk with these folks about why they want to become a contractor. And One guy wants to do it because he wants to fight a custody battle for his daughter. Another guy wants it because he's a small-town cop and he can't make any money. Another guy has been doing it because he refused to be on the take with the L.A. police. And I won't say greed as much as financial necessity. They just can't make $500, $600 a day, you know, in a domestic job. And it's a trap almost because they lose families. They lose wives. They lose kids. Even though they're making money, they destroy their family life. And in many cases, they destroy their life. The team I was with for a month in Baghdad was blown up about 2.5 months after I left, killing one person and severely injuring one of the main characters in the book. And his wife had post-traumatic stress syndrome when he went back to work, and he had to quit his job, and he lost his home. And, I mean, it's a terrible story.
It certainly is, and I don't mean to underplay that, but there's also scenes that you write in these conversations that you have with these soldiers for hire, in which they sort of publicly mock the amount of money they're being offered, and they're going to hold out to the highest bidder, and they're going to make as much money as they can because they can pull down $150,000, you know, $175,000 in a year if they make sure they don't sell themselves too short.
Right, and I have to say, you know, from the comfort of our homes in America, we can sort of mock the idea of somebody wanting to make more money. But when you strap on that Kevlar and you put that helmet on and you rack your gun back and you head out on those streets and you watch the curling donut smoke from car bombs and listen to the bullets from snipers going past your head, they don't pay you enough.
No, true. But it's an all-volunteer thing, and here are these guys, you know, are heading into the situation to make as much as they can. And
why should they be doing that? There's absolutely no reason on earth that you should risk the lives of 12 men to get a diplomat to a meeting. I mean, right. that's the problem I have.
Health care, too. I thought this was interesting that they really aren't provided their own health care. They have to get their own insurance.
Well, they're allowed DBA, Defense Base Act insurance, which takes care of some of the things. When my team was blown up, for example, the guys that were bleeding that got picked up by the medevac had no problem with their health care. The guy that decided to drive back to the base and then when he got home get health care was screwed. So these guys are on the outside of the mainstream of both health care and insurance. And more importantly, I mean, things like post-traumatic stress, it's an extraordinarily stressful job.
Right.
To do this on a daily basis and to be, you know, shot at and to look at car bombs that almost take you out, there's absolutely no recourse for that.
Let's break off there to say thank you and get everybody else lined up. We'll get all the calls we can between now and the top of the hour for Robert Young Pelton, Licensed to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, let's get back to the calls right away. East of the Rockies, Greg is in D.C. for Robert Young Pelton, Licensed to Kill. Greg?
Good morning, Ian. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Robert, I would like to get your opinion. I read an article here from the Washington Post by Karen DeYoung stating that the Assistant Secretary of State, Richard Griffin, was fired over the Blackwater incident. He's the charge of the Bureau of Diplomatic Security. And on top of that, there have been a series of other articles about the new embassy in Baghdad stating that the engineers, the technical engineers, can't design a secure embassy there. And looking back here to the incidents back in August of 1998 and all the funding that went into the Bureau of Diplomatic Security, it's very disturbing that this is going on. Do you have any comments, Robert?
Well, yeah. I mean, typically, if you go to another, forget Iraq, go to Algeria or another sort of high-risk location, at the first sign of any threat, they usually close down the embassy and send everybody home. It's been typical for the diplomatic security division to actually be very cautious in terms of protecting the lives of diplomats and government workers. I've been to places where they don't let anybody near the embassy, and they ring with locals, and then they have their sort of whacking huts or their security companies on the inside, but they don't drive around when there's car bombs or, you know, assassination attempts. Iraq is a weird, weird place because these people are forced. And in some of the articles you probably read mentioned the pushback by State Department employees who didn't want to serve in Iraq because they thought they might get killed. They didn't think that was part of their job to be in a combat zone. So it's a very unusual place. And the fact that Condi Rice and some of these other people have privately chastised and fired people and are having a hard time getting people to serve her, just shows you the conditions that, that Blackwater and the diplomatic service work under.
You know, is it just me or I just, do you feel this way that it's a little hard to feel safe when you're protected by somebody that says whack and hut on their shirt?
Well, they're all the same people. You know, they're hired from the military, and whether it's whack and hut or DynCorp or whatever, they're essentially a sort of a nomadic group of people that the brands change, but the product's the same.
I guess, but I mean, if you had it said DynCorp over a building, I'd go inside of it. If it said whack and hut, I'm not going in there.
By the way, I should mention that I have an article in Men's Journal this month about called Inside Blackwater, which I'm supposed to plug, but it talks about that State Department event and the fact that Blackwater is not the bad guy in that incident. Yes, there was a bad shoot, but they're basically being crucified by the State Department.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Jeff is in California on Coast to Coast AM for Robert Young Pelton. Jeff?
Yes, I may all be in California. And by the way, about five times a day at least, we have C-5s going over from Travis being refueled by DC-10s, probably going over the pole route to Iraq. An awful lot of planes going over there. Maybe they're supplying the contractors too. I was in the Air Force, got out in 78, and back then, there was sort of a wink and a nod that you could get out and go to work for DynCorp, make a lot more money than we were being paid to work on aircraft. But back then, it wasn't foot soldiers. It was more support roles. Now they've, of course, worked into where they are now. And my question, and you've partially answered it, is about whacking huts. We called them whacking heads because that's what they did at nuclear power plant protests and Nevada test site protests to the people that went out there. They also now guard grocery stores. And my concern is that people that are apparently now, whacking huts apparently are over in Iraq also based on what you just mentioned. What is their role over there and what is the impact of somebody who just came from Iraq going to work in a grocery store dealing with civilians or if there's a disaster, how much are we going to have to deal with whack-in heads?
Well, that's an interesting question because if you take the full spectrum of privatized security, and that goes all the way from the intelligence gathering aspect to the logistics support and the sort of infrastructure world, it's an extraordinarily large business. I mean, it is something that when they talk about the military-industrial complex, on one hand, I can say, yes, well, DynCorp was set up in 1947 to utilize our air assets. In other words, all the pilots and the aircraft and so on and so forth, and that made sense at the time. But it's become its own monster that has to be fed by wars. And you could make a statement saying that the Iraq War was essentially a for-profit venture to keep these companies employed. And in terms of asking what they're doing over, they're doing everything, whether it's handling dogs or whether it's serving food or guarding convoys. But as I mentioned before, it's not just Americans. It's a myth to think that all these billions of dollars are going in American pockets. We are looking for cheaper and cheaper ways, whether it's building the embassy with Bangladeshis or whether it's hiring Ugandans to sniff for bombs with dogs. We've turned this into a business, and the business has turned itself into a different kind of business. So it's a self-licking ice cream cone, as they say. It's something that needs to be examined very carefully. And hopefully stop, because there's no reason to have war as a business.
And yet, to go back to what you just said there a little bit more and amplify it, what percentage, I mean, what are the odds, do you think, that this was all just created to give all these companies jobs? And it's sort of a big mass distribution of national wealth.
Well, it's a double-sided thing. For example, what we did in the Balkans was use money as a weapon. We decided that if we keep large swaths of the population working, building bases and doing trivial things, they won't be shooting at us. Right now, we're hiring thousands and thousands of death squads so that they don't work for Al-Qaeda, and we give them money. Those people will be transitioned into peaceful programs. Money is a weapon, and that money has to be handled by private corporations if it's not handled by the CIA. So we do use money as a weapon, and we use corporations as sort of the gun to fire that weapon. But if you go to Iraq right now, what you see is a business that seems to not have an end to it. In other words, there's no reason for us to leave Iraq because it's so profitable.
Wildcard line, John is in North Carolina on Coast to Coast AM for Robert Young Pelton. John?
Yeah, I'm going to have to disagree with Robert just a little bit there. He made a statement earlier about the Fallujah deal was the reason why the the U.S. military leveled that entire city was because some contractors were killed. I disagree with that. The reason why they had to level Fallujah is because the infiltration and occupation of an entire city by the Al-Qaeda. And our military, the only way we can go in there is to be a little more savage than they were and to kill everybody, basically, because they were there to die. And the only way for us to help them meet Allah was to kill them. And I think we should do more of that. Forget paying people to be on our side. We should just start killing more people, too.
You'd fit in perfectly.
That goes directly against the guy who commanded the Marines in Fallujah, who did not want to go into Fallujah because he didn't want to waste the lives of Americans. It's one thing to say we're going to kill them, but they also kill us.
Yeah. No, and I'm not even saying that we should go in and go door-to-door. I'm saying we should carpet bomb, and my understanding was they did a pretty good job there, just blowing every building they could with anybody who even offered a little bit of resistance. But again, I don't think it had anything to do with the four contractors that were killed. In fact, it took them about 3 or 4 months before they even occupied that city after that.
John, well, I'm not sure.
Interviews with the commanders, they'll tell you specifically what their orders were, where they came from, and why they were initiated. And then
It's pretty well documented in the book, John. I mean, if you get licensed to kill, you can see more specifically how that connection is made. It seems pretty valid to me from having read it. You might feel differently after you read it, too. But I got to be honest with you, John, it doesn't seem all that different. What you're saying doesn't seem all that different from what Robert Young Pelton is saying. You just it sounded like you're just trading one kind of excess for another kind of excess.
Yeah. There's something else to point out there, too. That these contractors are now under the UCMJ while they're over there, which is just absolutely unbelievable that they changed a law about a year ago so that those folks over there could be prosecuted under military justice.
Well, they're under
all I'm saying is that anybody's over there as a contractor who agrees to be over there getting only a couple $100 a day, they deserve what they get, including punishment under UCMJ.
Well, let's talk about accountability. They're under a number of laws. They can be tried under UN war crimes if they wanted, but they're not. And in the case of the December 24 shooting, which a Blackwater contractor gunned down the vice president's bodyguard, he was just simply shipped out of the country and ended up working in Kuwait a few weeks later. It's really about the use of these laws, not necessarily that they exist, but the fact that the government will then prosecute people. More importantly, they don't want them to be prosecuted because once the Iraqis start suing them and once an Iraqi citizen starts suing a U.S. company for violating his rights, companies won't work over there anymore. The liability will be too high.
Let's go to John in New York City on the wild card line on Coast to Coast AM for Robert Young Pelton. John?
Yeah, Ian, I flew in the Navy for 20 years from Vietnam all the way to Desert Storm. And I've been connecting the dots listening to your show. And it's interesting that your guest has it brought up that in Kirkuk and Mosul, a place where an oil company on the West Coast named Aramco set up the infrastructure for the entire Iraqi people to pump oil, that those contractors, Ian, have been in there as security in those two areas of Iraq, even when Saddam was there. They were there. I used to fly them into Incirlik Air Force Base in Turkey, and they would go down into Kirkuk and Mosul. The interest of missing, what we're missing in this conversation today on your show, Ian, is all of these places in the world where we have put these people on the map is that the oil interests are ours, and we have protected them with contractors forever.
Well, if we're missing something on the show, it's all Robert Young Pelton's fault because I have no firsthand knowledge of this whatsoever. So,
well,
Robert, shame on you for missing something here.
You know, in the book I talk about how Dick Cheney, who obviously was president of Halliburton, actually tasked Brown & Root, which has now become KBR, which is part of Halliburton, to come up with a plan on how private industry could support military expeditionary activities, and then immediately gave them the log cap contract, which is the civilian support component of war fighting. So it's an idea that actually came from the oil industry, the idea that when you go off and build a refinery or build oil rigs, you don't reinvent the wheel. You hire outside companies to do it, and then you tear it down and get on to the next thing. And if you look at the people in the administration who are in charge of fighting the war, whether it's Bush or Rumsfeld or Cheney, they come from industry, and they look at this as a convenient, disposable way to fight wars.
Let's get to James in Utah, the wild card line on Coast to Coast AM for Robert Young Pelton. James?
In 1981, I was an Army MP assigned to work for the State Department, and, you know, that's peacetime. If we had to depend on our military to do that now for our diplomats, we'd have a lot of dead diplomats. And as far as the money goes, I'm 44 now, and with the skills that I have when I retired, it's going to take a whole lot more than $200,000 a year to put my life on the line to do that again. I've got a wife and five kids. I'm not in the Army anymore. You got to pay me to put my life on the line to take me away from my family, possibly forever. That's where they deserve the money.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the proposition. Yeah.
Yeah, but the problem is the South Africans and Nepalese that are doing that job now for $60 a day.
What Americans were getting $550 or $700 a day for are now going to Nepalese for $70?
Right. Well, right now, the good old days, you could make $600, $800 if you had a top secret clearance. Nowadays, a contractor is lucky to take home $400 to $500 a day, and those jobs are being eroded by, you know, like I say, South Africans, Nepalese, Chileans, people who have similar skills but are happy to work for one-tenth that price.
Okay. We have time. What was it, Rosa? Oh, Lisa, I'm sorry. Lisa in Ohio on Coast to Coast AM for Robert Young Pelton. Probably our last call. Go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, hi. My question is, I'm wondering about the situation when these people come back, as you're talking about they're coming back and being kind of auxiliary police force in this country. And since they don't seem to be governed by any of the regular laws that would govern the police, I'm wondering whether there'd be any recourse for the citizenry to, for instance, sue them, you know, if they overstep their bounds or if there are going to be any bounds. And then the second thing is, I'm wondering, what happens if these are private people hired by, you know, it'd be like a private army kind of, or private security force hired by somebody. What prevents there being kind of fights or little skirmishes between these private forces if somebody else has their own private force?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, quick answer is the folks in the Blackwater folks in New Orleans are actually deputized. If you flip their badge over, they were all deputized, and they were legal gun-carrying elements of law enforcement. That doesn't mean that a private citizen can't hire people and there can't be a gunfight between them and other people. Posse Comitatus is a very important law in which you're not supposed to have private standing armies in America, but many corporations and private individuals might argue that because when the riots hit or problems happen, there is no law enforcement. So are you supposed to stand by and be victimized, or do you go out and hire these guys and protect your interests? And that's a challenge that has yet to be met, but will occur at some point.
How about that? And then, ironically, there are some police officers in New Orleans who were deputized by the mafia. So, you know, had a weird little flip going on back and forth there. Well, thank you so much for your openness, as always, Robert Young Pelton, and for the way in which you handled all of these challenging questions and topics. License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. I understand it a lot better now, and I hope you stay safe and you grow old here in the United States with us around. God bless you and have a great weekend. Thank you. Deus Tiamat, and I do too.